I'm Dr. Noah Emery.
I'm Sam Acuff.
And this is the Addiction Psychologist Podcast, brought to you by the Society of Addiction Psychology. Welcome to the show. Today, we have Dr. Matt Field joining us. Matt is a professor in the Department of Psychology at the University of Sheffield. And our conversation with him today is going to focus on the different models in addiction.
Well, welcome to the show, Matt Field. We're really excited to have you.
Thank you for having me.
Yeah, absolutely. It's nice to sort of extend our interviews to the United Kingdom. How's it going over there?
Well, it's getting dark. We have about 6 hours of daylight a day at the moment. So it's 3:30 in the afternoon and the nights are drawing in. But and of course, Christmas is only a week away. So I'm winding down for work, which is good.
Yeah, well, I'm glad we were able to get you in, before the holiday season really got going in full. Mm-hmm. Could you tell us a little bit about your training history?
Sure. So I consider myself an experimental psychologist. I've got a PhD in experimental psychology, which I got from the University of Sussex, which is in Brighton on the south coast of England. And that I worked with Professor Theodora Duca, who her background is really in neuroscience. But my project was on associative learning with tobacco. So basically trying to teach people to associate tobacco smoking with arbitrary cues so you could model the development of cue reactivity. And then after I didn't do much alcohol work there. And then I also moved to, for my postdoc, I moved to the University of Southampton, which is also on the south coast of England. But about 50 miles further along. I'm just explaining the geography because I'm assuming many American viewers won't have any idea where these places
are. It's helpful to me, and I'm sure it'll be helpful to them.
South coast of England, looking at France. Yeah. So then I went to Southampton, and I did my postdoc there with Professors Karen Mogg and Brendan Bradley. So their background was mainly in attentional biases and anxiety mainly, but they had a project looking at attentional biases in addiction, particularly tobacco addiction. So I was there for 3.5 years doing a lot of the work that I've published on attentional biases. And then after that, I got another terminology alert. I got my first lectureship at the University of Liverpool. And a lectureship is basically a tenure track position.
Okay.
So, and then I guess that's the end of my training, really. Once you get your first tenure track position. but yeah, I was at Liverpool for about 14 years, and I moved to the University of Sheffield just over 2 years ago.
Yeah, we really actually do appreciate all of the help. It's funny, we're all doing similar things. Academia looks pretty similar, but it does have a lot of different names.
Yeah. So, yeah. So if you ever, and sometimes I've talked to people in the States when you talk about getting a lectureship, and people think, well, I don't want that. It's a teaching position, but it's exactly the same as a tenure track post. It's misleading. It's kind of a primarily research position with some teaching obligations.
It's the equivalent of an assistant professor.
Exactly.
Position, which is the entry level tenure track.
Yeah. That's exactly
position.
What it is.
I think academia is really good at the what we call the jingle jangle fallacy, which is multiple names for the same thing or the same name for different things.
Yeah.
Right. And a lecture, I think, is one of those specific ones that kind of happens here a lot.
Yeah. Yeah. And I think, my cat's come to join me. Many British universities are actually switching to the American terminology. So we now, sometimes you go for an assistant professor and associate professor. So Americanisms have crept in even there.
Well, everywhere you go, it seems like that might be the case. For better or for worse.
No doubt.
Well, today we're looking forward to having a conversation about, different theoretical perspectives on addiction and understanding the etiology, maintenance, and recovery of it. And we were wondering if you could sort of help us outline a little bit of what would be maybe considered the dominant understanding of what addiction is today.
Yes. So I think, when we think about addiction, the problem that we're trying to explain is, why do some people continue to drink alcohol or take drugs or perform another behavior like gambling, if all of those behaviors that cause them harm? Why do people persist with those behaviors even though they're doing them harm? And many people consider this an essential part of the definition, in that it's not sufficient that the behavior is doing them harm, but also that they should have tried and failed to change that behavior. Although that latter part is not necessarily essential, if you look at the DSM criteria, for example. But that's the problem we're trying to explain. And the generally accepted explanation is that repeated use of drugs or performance of certain behaviors like gambling, they result in a brain disease, and that brain disease results in behavior becoming compulsive or habitual. And what that means is that when you start out using a drug or drinking alcohol, it's initially voluntary, but then over time that behavior becomes very much out of control. So you're no longer, it shifts from being voluntary to out of control, and by that we mean that people would prefer to do one thing, such as reduce their substance use or abstain altogether, but instead they continue using. And I think that's a fair characterization of the generally accepted view of what addiction is. And you'll see that on the NIDA website, for example, but also in publications in the very best journals in the field over the last 20 years, including things like the New England Journal of Medicine, Nature, Science, all the annual reviews journals, and so on. And so the emphasis is on a shift from voluntary behavior to compulsion and habit. And it's helpful to break that down a little bit to think about what do we mean by those things. So compulsion means persistently performing a behavior despite adverse consequences. And some people would add on, it's not enough, as I've already kind of alluded to, it's not enough that you persist with the behavior despite adverse consequences. It might be that you persist with it, but you persist with the behavior, even though it produces adverse consequences, and those adverse consequences may mean that you would rather stop doing that behavior. So that's compulsion. And then habit, slightly different. This is a behavior that occurs independently of its outcome. So to illustrate that, you could think about someone who smokes tobacco, smokes cigarettes. That person might reach for and light a cigarette despite being fully aware that they shouldn't do it and that they wish they didn't have to smoke. That would be an example of compulsion. But that same person might reach for and smoke a cigarette without necessarily realizing that that's what they're doing. So that would be an example of habit. And there's various different, obviously that's a simplification, but that's the dominant model, and there's lots of variations of it. But there's various types of evidence that you can refer to in support. I'm just going to pause there to see if you want to interrupt me, because it was a monologue.
No, that was an excellent explanation. And the brain disease model, as far as I understand it, it sort of came about maybe the earliest snapshots of it was with the Minnesota model. I think a couple of doctors in early 1950s developed this model, and then it really sort of hit maybe its peak in 1997 with Alan Leshner's science article, Addiction is a Brain Disease and It Matters. And it's been... there are some reasons why this model has become dominant. Like, just, it grew up in sort of the era of neuroscience and cognitive neuroscience, at a time where we thought we were going to be able to explain everything, by, narrowing causes down to individual, neural actions. And obviously we've made a lot of progress in neuroscience, but we can't do that. But that's one reason why I think the brain disease model evolved as it has. But there are other reasons too. Like, I think that the brain disease model is an attempt to defend against stigma, right? Did you get that sense, Matt?
That's the claim, that the alternative to a brain disease model is one where you blame people for making the choices that they do. So the standard framing of this problem is, if it's not a brain disease, then people must be inflicting this harm on themselves voluntarily, and therefore they should be punished for that. And the brain disease framing is, well, this is a way, it's a way of expressing that people shouldn't be punished because actually they have a disease, much like any other disease, and we wouldn't punish people for having depression or schizophrenia or dementia, and so which are other diseases of a kind, and therefore why should we punish people for having addiction?
Yeah, I think that's an important element, and it's done some good, I would say, probably in the public health narrative, the idea that that there's something that's kind of outside of just simply making choices that mm-hmm. is influencing a person's behavior, especially when it seems to be, you know, in direct opposition to their long-term well-being or the will or wishes of themselves or other people. Mm-hmm. And I think it's probably done some good, but I think it also has done some harm. And when you start to talk to people like in addiction recovery or in treatment facilities, for instance, and there's some empirical work on this too, that kind of say like, oh, well, I have this brain that's different than other people, and therefore I'm absolved of responsibility for my actions, or I got this broken brain and I'm different than other people, so I'm stuck, you know, this kind of terminal uniqueness that like, I'm so unique that I can't be fixed in this way. And it's kind of boomeranged back around in some ways. And so I was wondering if you could talk to us a little bit about what do you think are some of the limitations or flaws of this model as it sits currently?
Yeah, so you've nicely summarized a lot of them there. But yeah, the claim that the idea that that it would reduce stigma simply isn't borne out by the evidence. And across lots of different psychological disorders, there's good evidence that once you start talking about something as having a kind of organic basis as it being a brain disease, and a lot of this work has been done on people with schizophrenia, then what you find is that this label actually increases stigma, and also increases what's called sometimes prognostic pessimism. So people feel less able yeah. to manage their symptoms. And so however well-intentioned, there's not much evidence that it has actually reduced stigma, and if anything, it might have increased it. What it might have done, as I say, is it might have it sets the stage for addiction as a medical disorder, which can then be treated as any other health condition with medical interventions. But yes, in terms of reducing stigma, there's not much evidence that it's done that, and a bit of evidence that it's had the opposite effect.
Yeah, and I think the medical intervention part is an important positive addition to the narrative, that prior to medicalization of addiction, it was kind of viewed as a moral issue, or even there's addiction as sin model, which goes back to the ancient mm-hmm. times, right? And you know, punishment was part of it, but also, you know, just generally like, you know, spiritual related treatments and things like that, or repentance and things like this. And I think the medicalization of it has advanced treatments and funding for treatments and understanding of addiction recovery science in meaningful ways, but it kind of has plateaued in some meaningful ways, as you kind of really alluded to here. And so what are some of the alternative models to the addiction as a brain disease, or an acquired brain disease, as some refer to it too?
So you can talk about a lot of my work at the moment is you can think about it in a behavioral economic within a behavioral economic framework, and I'm relatively late to this behavioral economic party, but the essence of this argument is that people's choices are driven by their underlying values, and therefore what this means is people will take drugs if they value drugs highly, and they'll stop taking them if and when they cease to value them highly. So for example, if the anticipated costs of drug use outweigh the benefits, and that's very simplistically put argument has got a long history in behavioral economics associated with various people who you probably know, such as George Ainslie, Gene Heyman, Warren Bickle, Jim Murphy, J. Lee Tucker, and this side of the pond, Nick Heather. And I think it's been broadened out a lot lately to consider that this idea, when put simplistically, is quite easy to dismiss if you think that the only value of drug use is intoxication, a purely hedonic, so changing your subjective state. But if you think about it, drugs and alcohol have a number of consequences, good and bad, beyond be it euphoria or intoxication. So lots of people with prominent distress, like others with comorbid conditions, use drugs to manage that. So you talk about things like self-medication, but also there's lots of people have pointed out that drugs, and it's a bit taboo to talk about it in this way, but drug use provides some people with almost a sense of meaning and structure to their life. It makes life simple. It fosters a sense of identity for some people, that their whole identity of who they are is bound up with their relationship with drugs or alcohol. This is really nicely articulated in the movie Trainspotting, which the Choose Life monologue in that, which is really emphasizing the many benefits that drug use has, which are kind of invisible, and they're not immediately apparent to people who don't use drugs. And this is about heroin addicts in Scotland. This isn't about people who just enjoy a few drinks now and again.
Right.
So that's a simplistic kind of choice view. And a few important details about it as the idea is advanced is that, firstly, the value that you attribute to drugs is relative. It's relative to other sources of value in your life, which is in the current label is substance-free reinforcement. And also the idea that valuation is not stable. So a lot of the work is on how... a lot of the work is on temporal discounting. So this idea that if you ask me now how much I value, I might value the idea of beer versus a soda, then I can report that to you. And at the moment, I value a soda. But when I finish this interview, it's probably going to be about 6 o'clock, and I'll probably be a bit tired. And my valuation of beer might well change, and therefore my preference might change. But the idea of the role of temporal discounting comes in importantly here. So once you can ask someone how much they value two things right now, but as the opportunity to actually consume one of those things draws nearer, then this directly increases the value of that thing. That's the idea there. So people's preference, the valuations are unstable. Just to kind of emphasize what I see as the key difference between this model and the compulsion model. With the choice model, there's still a pathology of a sort, but the pathology is in the way that people value drugs and value alternative reinforcers. You don't need anything. You don't need to refer to anything else, such as compulsion or habit or self-control. The pathology is purely in the valuation process, and that's the important difference as I see it.
Yeah, absolutely. I mean, there's a there's a good body of literature, and this started in the animal world, and it's worked its way all the way up to, I would say, even there are some public health intervention studies that demonstrate this effect. But, you know, a lot of the early animal work in this field would put a rat in a box alone with no other reinforcers, and it would see how much they self-administer. And under those conditions, a rat would self-administer close to death. You just continually take heroin, right? At some point, people started to realize, well, that's not how we as humans interact with, you know, drugs in the environment. We often are, you know, drugs aren't the only reinforcer. You know, there are a range of competing reinforcers. And so when you actually put other rats in the cage or you put a running wheel or food, or, you know, sugar water, that the animal's behavior actually shifts. And so while we tend to see this compulsion maybe at face value in a lot of the early research, and then also what looks like compulsion for many people out in the real world, what the choice model sort of suggests, and let me know if I'm getting this right, Matt, is that well, actually, based on the relative value of the substance compared to what else is in their environment at the time, and based on the way that they discount future rewards, they are going to be more likely to be selecting, you know, a drug reward than something else.
Yeah, that's right. And you're right that things in animal models have certainly started to change, and that with the particularly the work of people like Serge Ahmed in France, are changing the way that we changing the animal models of addiction that we use to so they more appropriately mimic the circumstances that, that humans are in. For humans, the choice is not between is not only to do drug. You have the choice to most people have the choice to do drug or do something else. And when they don't, then you start getting into things like social problems, social deprivation, etc. The idea is that the old model, animal models of addiction, where you have the animal only has an option but to self-administer drug, they're a good model of human existence in conditions of real deprivation,
right.
But which of course is important, but that doesn't mean that we should be that we shouldn't be we shouldn't use that to build models of addiction. And what you pointed out is that things have changed with animal research, but what I see the problem is that actually a lot of what we understand about the neuroscience of addiction, and indeed the models of addictive behavior that have arisen from a lot of that preclinical work, they are still based on those relatively simplistic animal paradigms. And it's going to take a while to update the neuroscience, I think, to see what's actually changed about the neuroscience of addiction when we make the drug taking conditions in animal work a bit more realistic and similar to how it is in humans.
I think that's a really, really important point. And actually, I think it leads to a question I've kind of had a little bit about it. And I think I've started to make sense of it in my mind, but I was hoping maybe you could help me kind of step through some of it. So the behavioral economic model or choice model, right, basically says that there's kind of the way that an individual is reinforced by things in their environment exhibits a specific pattern that produces this kind of choice making that is different than other people when presented with the same conditions. In some way, it's about how they place it, like purposely like this over that, making choices, or how it implicitly happens kind of in the background, in their kind of reward centers of their brain or things like this. And so I've always kind of wondered how we reconcile that a little bit with some of the thing that comes from some of the animal models, like George Kube has developed, like allostasis model, where the adaptations that happen biologically as a function of administering drugs to the brain, and the changes that happen as a function of that. How do we make sense of that process in this model?
Yeah, so I think George Ainslie's work is really important here. Where basically demonstrating that one thing that drugs do is that they if you repeatedly take drugs, they reduce the rewarding value of everything, mm-hmm. including the drug, but also including all other things you might do. So the idea here is that that if you take a lot of drugs, then you're, as in the Kube model, your allostatic set point shifts downwards. So what that means is when you're faced with a choice between smoking crack or going to the cinema, then you don't really want to do either. Neither of them are that appealing, but nonetheless, smoking crack still slightly edges it in terms of it has slightly more appeal. So I think you can reconcile the neuroscience there with the behavioral economic models, which are obviously more complicated than I've articulated here, because you can kind of go down the rabbit hole of the complexity of all this behavioral economic stuff, and it probably wouldn't make for a particularly interesting podcast.
Well, yeah, I think this is an important point, actually. And for me, I guess this is kind of an argument that I've heard people produce to me. A lot of my work lives in the space of emotions and the intersection between that and use. And for me, it advances the behavior economic model in a meaningful way, in that this, like, so people have different choices that they make based on behavioral economics and how they place value on things in their life. And then it kind of gets ahead of steam as a function of chronic administration of intoxicants to the body. And based on the changes that your body does to try and overcome perhaps overactivation of the reward centers, right? It releases cortisol, which is a stress hormone, which causes partially withdrawal and tolerance and these things. And so then the kind of difference between two things can get greater in magnitude very easily,
right,
based on withdrawal and tolerance and, you know, changing the set point in your reward threshold and what motivates you to get off, you know, like something that motivates me to get out of this chair, right? Like, you know, it has to be a certain amount of reward for that to happen, right? And then, you know, they just kind of get out of whack. And so for me, it's always kind of advanced it versus kind of come crashing against it.
Yeah.
So I always wanted to kind of step through some of that stuff, because I think it's important that these things aren't necessarily like different as much as they are like layers to the same process.
Sure. Absolutely. I think that's a great point. And one thing that, you know, one thing that behavioral economics emphasizes is molarity, and really patterns of behavior, what we call reward bundling. So when you're making a choice between sitting down, Matt, this evening, you might have the opportunity to work on a revise and resubmit for a paper, or you could drink a beer, right? And the reward that you would get from drinking a lot of beers over the next month, let's just say drinking every night, all day, all mm-hmm. night, and over the next month, maybe in the moment, it's actually very rewarding, right? But the collection of reward that you get over the time is not the same as the collection of reward that you would get over the time of working on your revise and resubmit and then hearing back from the editor in a month. Whereas, you know, sitting down to actually work on your paper now is probably a little bit less appealing than drinking a beer, right? So it's this idea of discrete versus patterned behaviors. And that's one part of drug use that makes it just appealing in general. But then, Noah, what you're saying is when you add the neuroadaptations that occur that make it even sort of harder to engage with some of these rewards that require bundled behavior over time, it makes it just ever harder to actually engage in these small discrete steps that would get you to that larger reward. So I think that was a really, really good point. And important, because while this model is sort of an alternative to the brain disease model, there are aspects of it that can really fit in well together.
Yeah, I'd agree. One counterpoint, though, is that you could use the allostasis model to really emphasize that the brain adaptations play a key role. But the danger of this is that actually, but what seems to be much more important is the fact that addiction is a disease associated with deprivation and poverty and lack of opportunities. And it's those social contextual characteristics which are likely to play a far bigger role than the drug induced adaptation. So that's I totally appreciate the you can reconcile the two things, but many would argue that it's kind of gone too far, and that we place the brain adaptation front and center, and we try and explain the behavior in that context, when in fact we should start with the social characteristics that are associated with addiction, the social and economic deprivation associated with addiction, and give the brain adaptations their due, but no more.
I think that's a really good point. And what you're saying is that an individual's context is going to be playing a really big role in the choices that they make, and, you know, whether or not they're susceptible to addiction. I think that this is counter to a lot of what people think about choice models of addiction. I think a lot of people, you know, and this was sort of briefly brought up at the beginning, but a lot of people think of choice models of addiction as inherently moralistic.
Yeah, absolutely. The idea being that if addiction ultimately involves if drug use ultimately involves choice, and if choice remains involved even as people develop addiction, then addiction should ultimately be that then people with addiction are ultimately bad actors, and they should be punished for that. And there's some really interesting work on this. But what comes out, what I've been reading from several people, is this idea that it's really a false dichotomy. You don't need, on the one hand, a disease or a compulsion model and a choice model on the other hand. There are And along with that, the choice model necessarily has to be a moral model. You can kind of break it down more usefully. So Hannah Pickard, who's now at Johns Hopkins, has written quite a bit about this. And in a recent paper, she's argued that you can split the kind of moral model or the choice model into two parts. So the first part is that drug use is a choice. So at the time that people use drugs, that's always a choice. But the second part of that is that people who repeatedly make that choice, as in to use drugs, they're selfish hedonists because they're hurting other people. So the reason being, you know, you're continuing to use drugs even though it's hurting yourself and family and your family members. And that second part is really that's the moral judgment. And Hannah's argument is that that's a remnant of puritanical moralism.
Yeah.
And so if you can kind of conceptually tease the two things apart, that drug use is a choice, and the only reason that's a problem is because we make these moral judgments about people using drugs, which are kind of have a long history that basically inherently using drugs is something you shouldn't be doing. But if we could kind of strip that out of it, then this problem largely evaporates, and we can be quite comfortable with the idea that drug use is a choice at the time that people do it. And I can kind of elaborate on that a little bit if you want.
Yeah, no, I'd love to hear how to tease it out.
Yeah, sure. Yeah. So when people live in conditions of extreme deprivation, it's quite likely that drug use or other, you know, other substance use might offer the only source of pleasure or relief from their suffering, and the costs of drug use might be easy to dismiss, and therefore it kind of makes sense but this isn't immediately obvious when you look at that, but for the observer, when you look at the choices that someone faces, they might appear to be self-harmful, but actually it becomes more complicated if you try and step in there, if you try and see the world from their perspective. The other thing that's Hannah Pickard's pointed out is that we know that drug use and problem drinking are incredibly harmful for health and for society. But what's harmful for at the kind of broader societal level might not be viewed that way by the person themselves. People may, we know that addictions have, there's a lot of comorbidity between addictions and other psychological disorders, and that the harm that people are doing to themselves might actually be viewed in a kind of perverse way, might actually be valuable to them. It might be a valued outcome of drug use. I'm not sure it provides an answer to this, but what it does do is if you try and break down why viewing drug use as a choice is a problem, I think that kind of is one way to kind of overcome resistance to it. I'm really not sure I've articulated this very well, guys. We might have another go at this.
No, I think you did it. I think you did it well. And I think it's important. This is something that's coming up a lot, I think, in more recently, especially as things around the world and attention around the world is getting kind of focused on inequality and contextual factors. And I think that's a really important point, right? That if you think about living in a state of deprivation, like poverty, for instance, where the reinforcers in your environment are sparse and the work to get them is large, right? Compared to, you know, substance use, for instance, which the access and the barriers to it are low, right? And the reward is high. It's immediate. It's certain. Right. And a lot of the negative consequences are delayed. And even some of the ones that happen immediately might actually be, if you were in their position, viewed as a positive versus a negative. And only in my position, I look at their position and say, how could you possibly? Right. But that's because I don't know what it's like to be in that position.
Well, I think
that's why you see some stuff like this.
It's inherently empathetic. In my opinion, the fact that instead of making a moralist, I mean, it's what we would do as therapists, you know, Matt, we both are therapists, Matt, Noah and I, you know, when a client walks into a room and they start telling me their story, I would never start to immediately just say, well, like, it's because you're a bad person. You know,
you wouldn't as a therapist, but as a society,
As a society, we do.
That's the thing,
right? Yeah. But we've started to, I think in therapy, we've started to do a better job in psychology as a whole of understanding things without necessarily that being related to the morality, right? Like someone can have done a terrible thing, have hurt someone very badly. And I can walk into a room as a therapist and I can come to a place where I understand it, right? And that's what understanding the context of a person's decision-making and the reasons why they did something. It's really beneficial in the therapy room, but it's also beneficial when we're talking on a societal level of someone who is a drug user. That individual didn't have access to other reinforcers. Maybe they didn't have access to a college education. Maybe they didn't have a father or a mother who modeled certain behaviors for them. Maybe they were in a friend group where the dominant way to connect was through drug use, you know? And I think that we always have to keep in mind that people are doing the best with what they have in the situations that they're in. I think that's always true. Mm-hmm. So I think that's sort of my take on it. And I think that you did a really good job articulating that point.
Thanks. I'll have to listen back to it, but yeah, I mean, I think in essence, it could be an empirical question and but it's a really difficult one to test because basically the disease or the compulsion model would argue that if someone resolves that I don't want to use drugs anymore, but if that person subsequently goes on to use the drug, what we want to know is at the moment when they made that decision, did they feel compelled to use the drug, which is what the brain disease model would argue? Did they feel that I don't want to do this, but I'm gonna do it because it's out of my hands? Or did they change their mind? Did they at that moment changed their mind? They made a snap judgment. I know it's not the right thing to do, but all things considered, this is the thing I want to do, and I'm going to smoke that crack, or I'm going to drink that beer, or whatever it is. And then they might do that, and then they might subsequently go on to regret it. But nonetheless, at the point of decision, did they change their mind? And it really, I think, it just boils down to that. But if you think about how that would be really difficult to test empirically, you'd want a big population of treatment seekers, you'd want to do something like experience sampling, and you'd want to capture in the moment what happened, what were they thinking just when they relapsed.
And
it could be done part. You see, it could be done.
Well, it could be done. You'd have to do it really thoughtfully. So I'm experience sampling or EMA researcher largely, and because that's one of the best ways to look at emotions. But to get into their thinking process, right? Like there's a bunch of, you know, permissive thoughts that happen here, or discounting future consequences versus, you know, immediate reinforcement and things like that happen in there. And I think it would be, we would really advance the field in a meaningful way if we could like drill down on what's going on in there and get a large enough sample of individuals to be able to characterize it in a meaningful way as a pattern.
And I mean,
that would do a lot.
And I think it could be done. I'd love if someone funded me or indeed anyone to do it. But you could probably get it in a way with lab studies with humans as well. You've got nice lab models of you basically give people a financial incentive to resist, and then make it increasingly more tempting. You know, you just maybe you I'm sorry, I'm designing an experiment as I speak, but maybe you say, I'll give you $100 if you can stay in this lab without drinking, and then you just progressively bring out more and more tempting alcoholic drinks, and then eventually you hope that they will give in to temptation. But what you want to know is, at that moment, did they do it because they felt they had to, or did they do it because they genuinely changed their mind?
Yeah.
And that's, for me, is the more interesting question. And overlaid on top of all this is this stuff about what is our problem with framing drug use as a choice. And I think, like I say, Hannah Pickard and others' really important contribution is to try and tease apart the fact that there's a moral judgment there, which, if we fall back on a brain disease model, that takes away the problem of making a moral judgment, but it also introduces a load of other baggage, which has arguably had a load of other unintended consequences.
This is an important point. I think that the part of the allure of the brain model is that it absolves the judger of having to judge them.
Yeah.
Right. Of the viewer, right? Not the person who's engaging in the behavior. And then it's very alluring in that way. It's immediately reinforcing for them to say, like, oh, you know, and I think one of the biggest problems from a public health standpoint on this is just straight up fundamental attribution error, right? That when I make mistakes, it's because of contextual factors, but when somebody else makes mistakes, it's because of their inherent traits, right? Yeah. That's how we view stuff, right?
Yes.
And that is imbued, right, in the entire discourse around addiction or health or public health or COVID or masks or all of it, right? Mm-hmm. And that it sometimes it is that simple, and that it's just so tempting to turn it back on its head for the person who's viewing individuals with addiction or who use drugs to say like, oh, it's a brain thing. Like, oh, I don't have to judge you now. Thank you for that.
Yes. Hmm. Yeah, I agree.
Well, Matt, this is a really interesting discussion. I'm just curious how this has informed the work that you're doing currently.
Yeah, so should say that like a lot of my work really up until quite recently was really on the compulsion end, really, although I didn't necessarily think of it that way. So the stuff I was doing on attentional biases, which is probably accounts for most of my publications, really, is really all that's all within a framework of dual process theory. But the idea there is that there are these automatic cognitive processes which basically influence behavior, and they bypass choice. The idea is that things like attentional biases, spontaneous assertions, all the things that implicit cognition researchers study, the idea is that you can make a value-based choice that I do or do not want to use drugs, but through conditioning, basically, and through your drug use history, those implicit cognitive processes will conspire against you. And it's only kind of recently that I've thought about that, the bigger picture of that. And actually the thing that I studied the most, which was attentional bias, always was framed in this idea of attentional bias is this kind of, it's your unconscious conspiring against you, if you like. But actually and I don't really do that work anymore, but the last paper I published on this was in 2016, but the way I see it is actually attention feeds into your value judgments. So if you look at something a lot, you value it more. And if you look away from it, you value it less. And actually, although a lot of the work was kind of thinking about attention as something separate to value-based judgments, actually, I think if things like attentional biases do influence behavior, it's probably through a valuation mechanism. Mm-hmm. And similarly, for the work I was doing on things like automatic avoidance tendencies, so this other aspect of implicit cognition, is typically viewed through the lens of dual process theory, as in these are things that bypass your better judgment. But actually, there's no reason why they wouldn't, and it's not really been empirically tested. Maybe if these kind of implicit cognitive processes ultimately influence behavior because they affect your judgments of what's your value judgments, basically. And more recently, I did quite a bit of stuff on inhibition, self-control, but I was particularly interested in the cued inhibition. So the extent to which when you're faced with a picture of alcohol or you're smelling an alcoholic drink, this causes this temporary dip in self-control, which the standard framework is this should bypass your best intentions. So you might want to abstain, but then you smell a drink, this dip causes your self-control to dip, and therefore that's why you end up drinking. But actually a lot of recent work on self-control, particularly cued inhibition, proposes that you can all integrate this within value-based decision making, within a valuation mechanism, in the sense that self-control choices are value-based choices much like any other. So that's kind of a brief history of a lot of the work I've done, which has always typically seen it as kind of outside of choice, and if anything more aligned with this idea of compulsion, but now I've kind of changed my mind. So now the work we're just starting up really is on particularly interested in something called value-based decision making. So I published a couple of conceptual papers on this now, both this year. But the idea of this is that people who do behavioral economics have a number of tools to measure the value of drug or behavioral economic demand, but they don't really tell you what goes on under the hood. And value-based decision making is something which it's arisen from cognitive neuroscience, really. there's this idea that basically the ventromedial prefrontal cortex is the site of what's called a common neural currency for value. So basically when people are making value-based decisions, at some level, this part of your brain is integrating all the information about that outcome, such as I could be considering, shall I smoke crack or shall I not smoke crack? So all of the idea is that all of the attributes which might feed into that decision are ultimately contributing to a single value signal. I'm not considering smoking crack right now, but I am. I might be considering, to go back to the other example, I might be choosing between having an alcoholic drink or a non-alcoholic drink. But the idea is that we have a pretty good understanding of how the brain makes these value-based decisions. And you don't need to put people in a scanner to measure these things. Some of the work we've done, so I've got a very good PhD student, Amber Copeland, who's been working on this with me at Sheffield, and I'm working with Tom Stafford, who does a lot of decision modeling. So we've been starting to think about this recently. But basically, you can do these decision-making tasks where people make value-based decisions about alcohol or about alternative reinforcers like soft drinks. And then you can use the pattern of response times and errors to extract what you use is something called a drift diffusion model. So you apply that model to their pattern of response times and errors, and that enables you to extract two parameters, which are, one of which is called the drift rate or the evidence accumulation rate, which is perhaps aligned with the value that you attribute to the stimuli, the pictures that you were looking at. And then another parameter is called the response threshold, which you can understand as the strength of value input that's needed to trigger a behavioral response. So if that threshold is low, then you don't need much evidence to make that decision. So I know there's a lot of technical terms in there, but just to give you a concrete example, if someone was addicted to crack cocaine, what we would expect is if they were doing a value-based decision-making task involving pictures of cocaine or thinking about different images of crack cocaine, what we'd expect is that their drift rate or their evidence accumulation rate would be high and their response threshold would be low when they were making those decisions. And as a consequence, they'd be more likely, when faced with a decision to use crack or not, they'd be very likely to quickly decide that that was the thing they wanted to do, and that they wouldn't really deliberate very much before making that decision. Whereas if it was something else, if it was like, say, spending time with a family member, then they would be much slower to attribute value to that option, and they'd probably take a lot more time to make that decision. So when faced with a straightforward choice, shall I smoke crack now, or shall I go and do something else, like spend time with my children, then nine times out of 10, smoking crack is gonna be the option which wins. So that's the kind of, that's value-based decision-making as a general construct.
We did an experiment like this in a lab I worked in once, where we just had people rate bottles. Yeah. On a scale of 0 to 10. Yeah. You know, like how much you like it. And then we did it where they had a forced choice where we presented them with two bottles and measured the reaction time, how long it took them to pick between the two bottles. And you find an inverted U shape where things that are one, when you compare things that are like a 1 to a 10, it's very easy, quick decision. There's not a lot of processes that take place. You can do it really fast. But when you compare something that's like a 3 to something that's like a 6 or a 4 to a 5, it takes much longer. Right. Yeah. And this is just something simple like bottles, or we did it with faces also. But when you put it into a larger complexity of your environment and choices and life and family and eating and sitting and drugs and abstinence, it becomes a very complex thing.
Yeah, absolutely. And that's the way the setup you just described there is more or less what we've done as well. Actually, in the process of writing one of these conceptual papers, I had many different co-authors on it. But basically, I had my colleague Tom Stafford there, who's very precise and is accurate about how you can articulate this drift diffusion modeling and this kind of stuff. But on the other hand, I worked with some of the other people involved with Jaylee Tucker, who's does a lot of the I've got to call it hardcore behavioral economics, who was also very particular about other parts of it. So it was a really good paper to write, but actually it was quite a challenge to me to try and reconcile all these different complex things in a way that would be acceptable to everyone and that would also make for a readable paper. And sometimes I still struggle to kind of articulate it when we're discussing it now. But yeah, the point is that what value-based decision making could offer you is a way to get at the internal processes that precede why people make choices, why they're more likely to choose a beer now or but not later, or why they're more likely to choose beer over a soda. That's the idea.
Yeah.
And so we've only just started looking at this, really. At the moment, we're just at the ideas stage. But my PhD student, Amber Copeland, has been doing a few things. And what it appears, she's been doing a few things with tobacco smokers who've quit. And we've also done some lab studies. And what it appears is that all of the parameters that you can extract from the drift diffusion model seem likely to be important. So it might well be that a change in the response threshold in tobacco smokers when they're making decisions about smoking might be a really important marker of recovery. Now, I don't want to say too much because we haven't submitted this stuff for publication yet, and COVID's obviously set a lot of people's research back, if not stopped it altogether. In our case, we had these decision-making tasks, which we've been trying to move online since March, and we've had endless technical problems with this, but we finally got them ready after about 9 months. So we're hopefully able to kind of resume that. But yeah, we hope to be able to be writing up some of these papers in the coming months.
Yeah.
So look forward to having a better idea of what we found there.
Yeah, I think it's really interesting stuff. It is an important extension of the behavioral economic model, which has mostly attempted to describe molar patterns of behavior. I really like it for a lot of reasons I won't get into because they are too technical for the audience. But I do, yeah. I do love your work, Matt. And I think that, you know, just to go back briefly to some of your discussion about attentional biases and stuff, I you brought up a really good point that I think that value attribution, I got a revision comment on a paper recently about a criticism about behavioral economics. And they said, well, it kind of sounds like you're saying that the decisions are always rational. And it kind of also sounds like you're saying that it's deliberate. And they said that they didn't think that would be true. And I agree with that. And in fact, I think that my question is, what exactly is rationality, right? Like, if value is attributed in an unbalanced way across different choice options temporally, and that the value of a drug is immediate and the value of writing a paper is delayed, right? Mm-hmm. And then if you think about it on an even larger scale, on a public health scale, like what would be the value of building a road or of investing in a city in something that will be 10 to 20 years down the line? Where is the rational decision in terms of, you know, is it this super delayed option? Is it something that's just a little bit delayed? Is it the immediate one? I think the problem is that it's inherently relative and it's contextual, and there's no way to know like what the right answer is. So I think rationality actually as a word in this field should be done away with. It's not helpful. It's not a helpful concept.
I agree. And me and Amber and Tom, who are working on this project, have kind of gone round the houses actually about what are these parameters you get out of these drift diffusion models? What do they mean? Is it the same as saying it's how much you like it or how much you want it? And it's not the same, because if it was the same, then we wouldn't bother with all messing around with all this time consuming choice tasks and modeling. We just ask people. All this stuff on value-based choice, it's more than it feeds into people's stated preferences, but it's more than they're like a rational weighing up of the pros and cons of a given outcome.
And it's not deliberate. If we talk about, you know, our understanding of reinforcement and behavior is that doing something And then getting a reward makes it more likely that that thing's going to happen again. Very rarely do we think about that process and think about the likelihood of the reward happening again, right? It's not, but nonetheless, it's still kind of happens. So I think some of your earlier work about attentional bias and your explanation of it was really helpful for me to understand that. Although things can look like they support one theory, it often can also support another theory. And in this case, I think it's important to know that none of this is not none of this. Most of this is probably not deliberate, and there are things going on, like you said, under the hood. And that's why I really like some of this values-based decision-making stuff.
To pick up on that point, I mean, Reinhard Weers, who's kind of the godfather of implicit cognition and addiction stuff, really, or at least certainly one of many, in his recent conceptual work, he's moving away from dual process models to a model which is more aligned with this idea, these ideas about decision making, which basically argue that choice can sometimes be more the result of a kind of rational weighing up of the pros and cons, and at other times these things can be more the primary influence can be associative learning, which you're talking about. But it's not helpful to talk about two different processes. Actually, it's more useful to talk about kind of a variable threshold that influences that determines the primary influence on a decision.
Yeah,
and I see a lot of things moving in that direction now.
And I could talk about this all day long. This gets me fired up, but you know, for you, and for our listeners, we're going to move on to the take-home messages. So what do you think the take-home message is regarding your work in the choice models for people who are currently in recovery?
So I think people should focus on the things in their lives that are enjoyable or meaningful and rewarding, which have got them this far, and continue to focus on those things. So the things in our language of substance-free reinforcement, but also to acknowledge that basically whatever happens, your decision-making machinery is not perfect, and it's vulnerable to, it makes mistakes. And if that happens, it doesn't mean that that's something that you're doomed to repeat. It's just the way that our brains work. They get it right. They get it right a lot of the time. And if people are in recovery, then they've managed to reprogram their brains so that they're less likely to use drugs or alcohol or whatever in the future. But it's still prone to making mistakes. Hopefully that won't happen, but if it does happen, the things that have kind of got you this far, which are kind of having meaningful or enjoyable things in your life, are likely to be, they'll continue to be important.
What would you say to practitioners or therapists that are listening?
So when I think about treatment, I think we've got a lot of things. We have a lot of psychosocial treatments, talking therapies, which are of known effectiveness in things like motivational interviewing and cognitive behavior therapy and all the things that go along with that, like skills training, etc. And those things they're quite. I'm not a clinician, so I'm going to say this and I might be wrong, but my understanding is that they're fairly easy to implement, if you see what I mean. You can train people up and then they can deliver them. And equally, on the other side, we've got a lot of things that utilize the support of others, like family therapy, couples therapy, and I'll even extend that to AA groups. So the point is we have a lot of things here. We have a lot of talking therapies which are effective. They don't work for everybody all the time, but on average they work for a lot of people. And what we do need to, I think, is more research to try and understand the basic psychological processes upon which they operate. And so some of the work I'd really like to do is looking at how these kind of treatments, rather than trying to search for something new, look at what does work and try and understand how that affects the fundamental decision-making processes, which are really important for people to either initiate or maintain recovery, or which you might need to intervene at to prevent people relapsing. So we've got a lot of good stuff that works, and people should have, people who are clinicians or therapists, practitioners, should have faith that those things are doing good, even if they don't work for everyone. And I was listening to Katie Wickie, which is a podcast interview on your podcast, an earlier podcast, who's obviously was talking about the role of abstinence versus some people just have a different treatment goal, which might be moderation. And for that reason, things like AA might be off-putting to a lot of people. And I think that's a really fascinating area of research. So AA is not so popular in the UK as it is in the US, but it's still, you know, it's a lot of people benefit from it. But I think there's lots of things that we can learn from AA, such as the roles of social support and the substance-free reinforcement it provides, that we could really, I think it would be really good to try and emulate those things, but study them outside of the context of the AA philosophy.
I think that's probably
a divisive.
I think that's crucial, actually.
Yeah, no, I think a lot of people would probably agree with you. And do you have a take-home message for policymakers?
Here again, I'm repeating what Katie said in response to the similar question, but we have evidence-based treatments, and ideally, they should be more widely available. And an issue in the States is this health insurance. Not everybody has it, and therefore, not everybody is eligible for these kind of treatments. That's not really a problem in the UK and the rest of Europe, where we have kind of universal healthcare. And well, you were on the road to getting universal healthcare, and then you got a new president. But anyway. Yeah, the point is that stuff's available, and you should make it as available as you possibly can. And I would even extend that to a lot of the medications that we have, many of which are off patent. Things like naltrexone, methadone, you know, they're widely available, but there are kind of cultural, societal reasons why they're as well as financial why they're not widely used, which we should kind of overcome.
Yeah.
Yeah, and things like AA, I have to agree with. So John Culley's review of AA, John Culley calls it a free lunch, as in. So you might disagree with elements of it, but nonetheless, it's providing a service that it might be the only service that some people can access. And I have to agree with that aspect of it, and therefore the message to policymakers is, you know, make use of it.
Yeah.
What would you say is some maybe some take-home message for like underserved populations, you know, individuals with experiencing poverty, homelessness, or racial, ethnic differences?
So I thought about this, and I'm not sure that my message would be directed at underserved populations, but I have got some thoughts about what we as researchers and also for policymakers might want to think about. One of it is that we sink a lot of our research funding, and this is particularly true in the US, it's perhaps less so in the UK. A lot of research funding is devoted to kind of neuroscience and neuroscience-based treatments, including pharmacotherapy, but also things like brain stimulation. And those things, if they ever turn out to be effective or more effective than what we ever have, are less likely to be available to those underserved populations. And therefore there's the really important question to have about the extent to which we want to find new treatments for the sake of, if we just want to find out what works regardless of the practicality of its implementation, then that's fine. But perhaps practicality of implementation should be a bigger consideration, which might ultimately then benefit underserved populations. And then the other point is that we've talked a lot about substance-free reinforcement, but a lot of that is down to people's social and economic circumstances, so the opportunities that they have or they don't have, and those improvements in those things are likely to be really fundamental to help people get to recover from addiction. And really, that's not the addiction psychologist's job. It's the economist's job. And you know, hopefully the US is things are going to improve in that regard with the change of the administration. Well, they couldn't really get much worse.
From the overseas perspective.
as it relates to this. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, yeah. I think it's a great point. I really love in particular the point that like, well, even if these neuroscientific approaches are really effective, that, well, who is that going to benefit? So that's an important thing for us to think about, I think, as psychologists, but also as a nation. So thanks for making that point. Matt, it's been really awesome having you on. Last question. Do you have any advice for trainees out there to help follow you on your wildly successful career path?
Again, I listened to Katie's podcast, and I'd echo what she said about choose something that you're enthusiastic about and you enjoy, because I think that's really important. And then, because then it just makes when you're doing research, it makes it feel less like work and it's more intrinsically interesting. And also the points about collaboration and mentoring. It's really important to collaborate with good people and to have a mentor. What I would add to that, though, is that I think early in your career, I think it's really important to try and specialize. And I mean, to try and nail a specific subject. And I mean, that's what I did. I really tried. And the reason this is useful is because it's not easy to master a new topic. I'm new to this behavioral economics stuff, and I'm still, you know, I can't articulate it as well as I could have some of the stuff I was working on sort of 10 years ago. But early in your career, it's really important to try and nail and master a particular topic to the extent that you feel that you've made a contribution to it and that you know, you've made a lasting contribution to it. Because when you get to that stage, people will want to collaborate with you when they're interested in that particular topic. And then you can kind of have the flexibility to take a few risks and change research areas, which I'd say I've done a couple of times now. But I would say for trainees, like, don't specialize too early. It can be so tempting to try and do a bit of this and a bit of that. And that can pay off if you've got a big supportive network. But quite often, and this has happened to me in the past as well, I've ended up trying to juggle too many research interests and I've ended up kind of not really doing any of them very well. So it's better to specialize in earlier in your career. Yeah. And then the other thing I would say is that just some kind of expectation management a bit is that I don't actually feel I've been as successful in the last few years as I had been earlier. So for example, I've not had any major grants as a PI for about 5 years, but obviously continue to publish papers, although recently kind of more conceptual papers. Now, some people would judge that as not particularly successful. Now, just indulge me with this a bit, but basically in my case, I've been kind of less productive in terms of grant funding because, I had kids. I had kids quite late in life, which kind of derails everyone a little bit. Yeah. But I also moved jobs. And I also tried to kind of refocus my career from the kind of attentional bias and inhibition stuff. And the reason I raise this is because I think if as junior people, if you look at people who are successful in the field, I don't think anyone who is on the outside successful is likely to be successful throughout their career. And everyone has patches where they're less successful and more successful. So although I haven't had any significant funding for quite a few years now, I'm not unduly worried about it. I'm confident that I will do in the future. And if I don't, I think I'll probably get by, if you see what I mean. But it's important to bear in mind because, you know, I had a good start to my career. I had a really productive postdoc, and then I was really productive when I was a lecturer, an assistant professor. But other people other people kind of came into their own kind of mid-career, really, or even late career. And I think that's really important to bear in mind that when you're just starting out, just because you're not incredibly successful early on in your career doesn't mean that success won't come later. And don't get too cocky if you get successful earlier on, because there will come a time when things don't work out in your favor so much, or when your life priorities change a little bit.
Right. Well, I think if we talk about shifting values, having kids, having kids is probably, Noah's in this spot right now, new parent. And I am nowhere near that. So my value might shift in, you know, 5-10 years, but I think that makes a lot of sense, and that's really helpful perspective to keep. And I still have really loved reading your conceptual papers, and I, in my opinion, you're very successful. But
agreed. Yeah.
Yeah.
I mean, that comment brings us full circle. Yeah.
Yeah. Well, thank you so much, Matt. It's been awesome having you on, getting to talk to you a little bit. And yeah, just appreciate your time.
Yeah. Well, thank you very much for having me on. It's been a pleasure.
Next time on the Addiction Psychologist podcast, we're going to be talking to Dr. Alan Budney. Dr. Alan Budney is a professor of psychiatry in the Geisel School of Medicine at Dartmouth College. He's a director of Dartmouth's T32 program. A few weeks ago, the House of Representatives attempted to pass a bill that would legalize marijuana at the federal level. And although it did not pass, we thought it would be important to have an expert on to discuss what the implications of cannabis legalization would be in the United States. So we're going to be having a conversation about all of the possible outcomes and what it might look like for public health.